Welcome to Your Health, a weekly podcast from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. Over the past couple of weeks, we've done a lot of reporting on the new H1N1 swine flu, and a couple of times we asked you, our listeners, to send in questions. So here's the first segment we ran in which we answered some of your questions, which focused at that time largely on the vaccine itself. Here's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep.
We're going to get some answers this morning from two of our science correspondents and a few other experts. And we begin with NPR's Joanne Silberner, who's on the line. Joanne, where are you?
I am at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They have something called the Emergency Operations Center, where they take in information on swine flu outbreaks and vaccine availability. And pretty much everything on swine flu is being collected and analyzed here in front of me. There's a dozen screens with maps. They've really drilled for this, and they're taking this in stride.
So if you can't answer a question sitting where you are, we should be very, very afraid, pretty much.
Well, I have people here to help me answer questions. How's that?
Well, let's go through a couple. We'll start with our first question from Lisa K., last initial K., of Malvern, Pennsylvania. She writes, "The swine flu shot will not be offered by my family doctor. How exactly will this work, and where can I get my shot? So how will it work?"
Well, it's being run by the government. The government has already purchased essentially all the vaccine being made. And the states go to the CDC to order, and each state gets a percentage of what's available based on how many people live in that state. Then it goes from the distributor directly to school districts, clinics, hospitals, pharmacies, about 90,000 places across the United States. And last week, millions of vaccines went on their way to the distribution centers and to the states. And that includes both the regular injectable vaccine and a new nasal spray version that's based on one that's already used for seasonal flu.
So that's the first part of her question, how will this work? And then her next part is, where do I get my shot?
Well, in Lisa's case, her doctor could apply to the state and get vaccine from the state, or she can call up her state health department, the Pennsylvania Department of Health, by its website or phone, and I think that's going to be true of most states.
We've also got questions from listeners who've written in with very specific questions about safety, Joanne, and we're going to get to those specific questions in a moment. But for right now, I just want to ask, are some of the people on those computer screens that you're looking at monitoring safety issues?
Yes, they're monitoring everything there is about this infection. And one of the people who's considering all the information that's being gathered, sitting right next to me, and her name's Dr. Beth Bell. She's with the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases at the CDC. And I'm just going to hand her off to you.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Bell. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us here. I'd like to know how you think you're going to know if this vaccine starts to become a problem as you distribute it to those 90,000 sites across the country.
We are working very hard to make sure that we can closely monitor for adverse events once the vaccine is distributed. For example, we're working with a number of managed care organizations to track any adverse events that occur in their populations very quickly and to decide whether it's something to be worried about or not.
Are the side effects from the swine flu vaccine any different from the seasonal flu vaccine that many people get at the same time?
So far, the side effects are actually very similar. People will get a sore arm sometimes. Some people might feel a little bit tired, have a little bit of a headache. The kinds of side effects that one can expect to happen sometimes with various kinds of vaccines.
Dr. Bell, thanks very much. If you'd hand the phone back to Joanne Silberner, I'd appreciate it.
I certainly will.
Hi, Steve.
Just one other quick question. This emergency operations center that you're in the middle of, did they set this up just for the swine flu?
Oh, no, this is a place that's open 24/7. They deal with things like hurricane response, foodborne outbreaks, any other major public health event, they can deal with it here.
NPR's Joanne Silberner is at the Centers for Disease Control, the Emergency Operations Center there, and we're going to hear next from NPR's Richard Knox, who is monitoring developments from our studios here. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
He's our health and science correspondent. And how widespread are the safety concerns about this vaccine?
There seem to be a lot of worries out there. There was a poll the other day from the magazine Consumer Reports that found that two-thirds of parents are saying that they are either holding off on getting their kids vaccinated or they've decided not to have their kids vaccinated. Their main concern is that they think the vaccine may not have been tested well enough.
Let's listen to one of the questions that people have sent in.
Was it subjected to the same testing as the regular seasonal flu vaccine, or were shortcuts taken as it was rushed to market?
This gentleman's identified as Dr. Ian Zlotkis, somebody who asks questions himself, even though he is a doctor.
That's right. I think he's not alone out there. And for the answer to that, I'd like to go to Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
The H1N1 flu vaccine is made exactly the same way with the same processing, with the same materials as we make seasonal flu vaccine, which has an extraordinarily good safety record.
He makes another point. He says the new vaccine really shouldn't be considered a new vaccine, a brand new vaccine at all. It's like what they do every year with ordinary flu vaccines. They make little changes, they tweak it, they call them strain changes. It's just that this is a very big strain change.
We had a question also from Erin Bolton of Baltimore, and she's in a group of people that has been strongly urged to get this vaccination. She writes, "I'm pregnant. My baby is due in December. I'm planning to get vaccinated," she writes, but she's concerned that results of vaccine studies in pregnant women aren't in yet, and she wonders whether she should wait.
I put Erin Bolton's question to Dr. Frank Witter. He's at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore, and he's an expert in maternal-fetal medicine.
Erin, you should take the flu vaccine. Not only should you take the seasonal flu vaccine, but you should also take the pandemic flu vaccine. Pregnant women have gotten very, very sick from this new virus and have actually died. So you should take the vaccine.
Strong warning there, Richard Knox, but this is something that a lot of women may be reluctant to do when they're pregnant.
I think a lot of pregnant women are very reluctant to take anything. But we already know that pregnant women are much more likely to get swine flu. If they get it, they're like six times more likely to die from it. And that's really what Dr. Witter is emphasizing. A lot of his obstetrical colleagues worry that if they urge a woman to get vaccinated, then she happens to miscarry. It may have nothing to do with the vaccine because we have no evidence that the flu vaccines do cause women to miscarry, but they may blame it on the doctor. He says, well, you know, if that happens, I'd rather be blamed for a miscarriage than see a woman die from a flu that I might have helped her prevent.
We're taking listeners' questions about swine flu, and here's another one from Megan Guptill of Orinda, California. She writes, as a young person with asthma, I am in the group of people who are supposed to get the first round of the vaccine, but apparently she is hesitating, Richard Knox.
Yes, and by the way, people with asthma are a really big group. They're about more than 20 million Americans have it. The reason Megan is hesitating, I understand, is because she's wondering if she should get the first vaccine out of the block, which will be the nasal spray type. It's called FluMist. But people with asthma aren't supposed to get FluMist because it might touch off asthma attacks. So she's worried about getting swine flu while she's waiting for the regular vaccine to be available. Asthma experts are saying she should wait until she can get the regular flu shot, not FluMist.
We've been hearing, Richard Knox, about people who are worried about the vaccine, but let's talk a little bit here about people who say they are not that worried about swine flu. They wonder if it's really not that serious.
A lot of people have been asking that. I hear it all the time. For that answer, let's go back to Dr. Tony Fauci of the NIH. He's really the government's top flu specialist.
Although for the most part, it is a relatively mild infection, in the younger individuals who are getting infected, there's a small percentage, but a disturbing percentage, who go on to develop serious disease and even some deaths. About 30% of the deaths are in people who are otherwise young, vigorous, and healthy. You rarely, rarely see that with seasonal influenza.
You might ask the question the other way around, really. Wouldn't there be a lot of anger if the government had not developed this vaccine and a number of people, especially young, healthy people, had died?
Richard, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Richard Knox.
Since that segment first aired, we continued to hear from listeners with questions about the flu. This past week, Steve, Richard, and Joanne got together again to answer more of your questions on the new H1N1 swine flu.
Starting with NPR's Richard Knox, who's in Boston. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Steve.
I understand you've been spending some time at a pediatrician's clinic.
Yeah, I went out to Needham, Massachusetts. It's a Boston suburb, and I hung out for a while at the offices of Dr. David Greenis and his partners. It's a real busy place right now. The receptionists say that a lot of people get really mad. Some of them even lose it because they just can't get the vaccine. This is Marilyn Hapeny.
Some people have even apologized for being so nasty to us, but oh boy, I mean the three of us went home last week and cried, truly. Just being beat up all day long.
Meanwhile, people are getting sick at a greater and greater pace. Several nurses are taking calls from parents of sick kids. This is Nurse Nancy Clegg, and she's talking to a mom with a 2-year-old sick boy.
Well, you know, it could be the flu. It could be, you know, a virus. You know, we're not testing specifically for H1N1.
The pediatrician here at Steve, Dr. David Greenis, says that 9 out of 10 parents who come in have flu questions, no matter what they came in for.
Probably the biggest questions we get are, number one, people want to know how will they recognize if their child has the flu.
which is a natural question because the symptoms could be similar for swine flu, regular flu, or just a cold, I suppose.
That's right. You'd think doctors would know what's flu, but it's really not very easy to tell. The flu has certain hallmarks. One is a really ache all over feeling. It really knocks you out, and that's an effect that a cold might not have. And in terms of treatment, well, the good old-fashioned things are usually just fine. It's fluids, bed rest. But that advice isn't enough for some of Dr. Greenis's patients. Let's listen.
Some people have asked me really with sincerity, what can I do so my child won't die if my child gets the flu?
Terrifying question, but a fair one. People have died.
That's right, Steve. And so far, almost 120 children and teenagers have died around the country from this flu, and that's way ahead of most flu seasons. The most important thing that parents can do, Dr. Greenis tells them, is be vigilant. Few kids get into trouble, but it does happen, and even with healthy kids, it happens, and it can happen fast. So they need to be aware of some danger signs. Trouble breathing is one of them. If a kid is hard to wake up, if she's lethargic, if there's persistent fever, a really important one is if the lips are bluish or grayish. Greenis says basically, though, that parents should trust their intuition. They know their kids best. Call them if they're worried.
And what else did you hear of the people who had brought their children into that doctor's waiting room?
Well, I talked with one fellow named Jim Wilson. He's a real estate man, and he says the whole family, the whole Wilson family, is just getting over the flu, and he wishes that he'd known one thing earlier.
We weren't told all the ancillary infections you can get from it, the ear aches, the sinus problems, the strep throat, all these side infections.
So that's why, Steve, the doctors say they want to know if you don't get better within 5 to 7 days, or you get better and then get sick again. These are all signs of possible infections that come on after the flu, and they need to be treated.
You know, you mentioned that Mr. Wilson's whole family had the flu. I'm thinking of my brother, where most of the family has been sick, but not quite everybody yet. Should we assume that whole family is going to get sick?
Not necessarily. One mother in our pediatrician's office who came in with her two little girls asked an interesting version of that question. Her name is Stephanie Payne.
I work in a child care center, and my children attend a child care center. So I think my main concern is if one child gets it, how quickly it could spread through an entire center.
Well, we all know that flu can sweep through an entire daycare center or a classroom, but recent research shows that when somebody gets sick in a household, only 1 in 4 of the household members will get sick on average. The pediatrician here, Dr. Greenis, says that he's known couples who didn't share the virus, and he's known kids who didn't infect their siblings.
Although this leads to another question, because I have heard from people who've had swine flu or been diagnosed with swine flu who said, give me Tamiflu, give me that flu medicine, let me do what I can. Is that a good idea?
There are different philosophies on that. The official advice from the CDC says that Tamiflu should be considered for anybody with a condition like asthma or diabetes or other chronic diseases. Dr. Greenis, the pediatrician we talked to, is more conservative. He says that, you know, some kids have stomach problems with Tamiflu, and he doesn't want to make them feel worse. And other doctors, you know, worry about having too many people on Tamiflu because the virus might become resistant.
NPR's Richard Knox is in Boston, where he's been getting answers to some people's questions about swine flu. And we're going to bring another voice into the conversation now, our colleague Joanne Silberner. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Steve.
And where did you listen to people's concerns about the flu?
In Washington, D.C., and this was going to give you a little bit of an idea.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming out to DOH's H1N1 mass vaccination clinic program.
That's at Kelly Miller Middle School in Washington, D.C.
Right. So what we need from you is to please be patient. We're going to start letting people off in 5 minutes.
There was a line. There's definitely a line, and there is a shortage of vaccine.
And so who's allowed to get the doses, at least at the place where you were?
Well, generally speaking, it's pregnant women, people who care for very young children, healthcare workers, people aged 6 months to 24 years, and people 25 to 64 who have chronic medical conditions.
I guess you saw people who fit into at least one of those categories then online, right?
Oh, yeah. And here's one of them. This is Jacqueline Geller.
I'm currently 8 months pregnant, so I'm here to get a flu shot. And I have a daughter who's 1-year-old, so she's here to get a flu shot as well.
You know, we got an email from another mother. Her name is Tara Lund. She's in Portland, Oregon. She's got a couple of young kids, 6 months old, 2 years old, and this is her question. If they get the flu before the immunization is available, should they still be vaccinated?
Yeah. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says yes. Unless Tara Lund's kids were tested using a very precise test for H1N1, she can't know for sure, if the flu that they had really was H1N1 swine flu, or maybe even not a flu at all, maybe a cold or something else. And if they get the vaccine and it turns out that they actually did have the flu, there's no real downside there.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned testing, because I've heard stories of people who've had what is believed to be swine flu, but they were never tested by the doctor, as well as people who have taken the test. Why would not everyone be tested if they went to a doctor?
The office test is really imprecise, so you don't know if you get a yes or a no in it, if that's correct. The good test costs a couple of $100. It's not widely available around the country, and it won't make a difference in how you're treated. You know, if you've got fever, aches and pains like Dick described, you still need to rest, get plenty of fluids, and stay home.
What other questions did you hear?
Well, the pregnant mother, Jacqueline Geller, raised an issue that we also hear a lot about from listeners.
Well, another friend of mine asked me today, she had heard that there was mercury in some vaccines, and she wanted to know if it was safe because she's pregnant as well.
Okay, is it safe?
Yes. When you get the vaccine, the H1N1 vaccine, from a multiple dose vial, it is preserved with something called thimerosal, and that does contain a form of mercury. That's true of the standard seasonal flu vaccine as well. It's very little mercury, less than you'd get in a can of tuna. And now, it's been said before, and I'll say it again, numerous scientific studies of vaccine have failed to show any connection between the mercury in vaccines and autism or any other problem. But if you're still worried, there are two mercury-free alternatives. Some H1N1 vaccine is available in single doses, and that doesn't contain any preservative. And the nasal version of the vaccine also contains no mercury.
So mercury doesn't present a problem, and even if it did, you can get the vaccine without the mercury.
That's right.
And by the way, we're still hearing sounds of that vaccination clinic in Washington, D.C., where Joanne did some interviews some days ago. And, you know, in all the questions we've received, there is one question that nobody asked, but it was very much on the mind of my daughter. Does the swine flu shot hurt?
It's over. Well, this young expert said it stinged a little bit.
Thanks very much. That's NPR's Joanne Silberner, and we heard earlier from NPR's Richard Knox. And you can go to npr.org for answers to more of your questions about swine flu.
So just how safe is that vaccine? Well, this past week, a panel of independent experts met to look at the data on side effects from the swine flu vaccine. They reviewed numbers from more than 10,000 people who've been vaccinated, and officials said there were no danger signals. The panel is part of the government's effort to reassure Americans the new vaccine is safe. The government knows many people have concerns. As NPR's Richard Knox reports, there are plenty of vaccine opponents out there to feed those doubts.
It doesn't take long to find stuff on the internet slamming the new flu vaccine. Here's one I found from a blogger named David Icke.
If you do only one thing to protect you and your family, then do this. Don't have the vaccine. Don't have the vaccine. Tell as many people as you can, don't have the vaccine.
Icke thinks swine flu vaccine is a global conspiracy to depopulate the world. That's one of the more extreme views I've found. Dr. Howard Markell at the University of Michigan says vaccine opposition comes in many flavors.
The reasons are really all over the place, but there are enough people who are concerned about getting vaccine that we as doctors and public health professionals have to at least listen to those people and try to convince them otherwise.
Markell studies flu pandemics. He says this one comes at a time when trust of authority is at a low point. It's also a time, of course, when anybody with an axe to grind can get an instant internet audience. Markell thinks government officials have been doing a pretty good job of selling the new flu vaccine. Peter Sandman disagrees. He specializes in communicating about risk, and he's a consultant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
They've done an okay job talking to people about the virus. They've done a terrible job, in my judgment, or at least a pretty poor job, I'll give them a C-, in talking to people about the vaccine.
Sandman says in their heart of hearts, public health officials see themselves as the good guys, and they believe so strongly in vaccines that it's hard for them to acknowledge many people's uneasiness.
There's something deeply embedded in human psychology, something hardwired that makes us anxious about vaccination. There's something sort of intuitively weird about vaccination.
It seems unnatural to many people to inject something that causes a disease in order to prevent it.
When you get the sort of generic mistrust of government combined with the intuitive mistrust of vaccination, that's a potent combination.
Sandman advises the CDC to send a different message to skeptics, something like this.
We'd rather you got vaccinated now or as soon as you can get some vaccine, as soon as the supply is there for you. But if you're skeptical, okay, you know, we don't want to coerce you into rolling up your sleeves. We don't even want to pressure you into rolling up your sleeves.
So wait and see whether bad things happen to people who get vaccinated. See if the pandemic continues to get worse and decide later whether to get the vaccine when more of it's around. For now, the CDC is plowing ahead with its insistence that the vaccine is safe. It's also monitoring social media to keep track of the opposition.
Well, you know, it's a really challenging communication environment that we all work in these days.
That's Christine Sheedy of the CDC. She's in charge of marketing the new H1N1 vaccine. About half of Americans aren't buying it, according to the CDC's polls and focus groups. That's partly due to a sense that the vaccine was rushed to production. Many are also convinced it contains harmful chemicals. That's not right, the CDC says.
There's a lot of information out there that isn't all correct and can be, you know, frightening and does call into question the information that we at CDC and other public health officials put out about vaccines. And that's having influence.
The CDC has been trying to counter the misinformation, but a shortage of the new vaccine has stalled the agency's big $2 million media campaign until mid-December. Richard Knox, NPR News.
So you're surfing the web, looking for the best advice on how to treat your child who's come down with the swine flu. You get to the CDC website. That's an obvious place to go. But as you're reading their how-to on caring for children with swine flu, you start to think, gee, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Some doctors who visited the site have had the same reaction because they say the CDC advice goes too far. NPR's Deborah Franklin has the story.
Jen Hodson and her seventh grader, Soleil McDonald, live in Portland, Maine. And when Soleil came down with swine flu a couple of weeks ago, Hodson, like any mother, sprang into action with hand sanitizer, Tylenol, and chicken soup. She called her doctor and looked online at the CDC website to see what they were telling parents. There were some good tips, she said, but then this other stuff.
They said that people who have the H1N1 should be kept kind of segregated from the rest of the household, and that if they have to be in common areas, they should wear face masks, and that they should be isolated, basically.
The website said parents should try to stay at least 6 feet from their child. If you must have close contact with a sick person, for example, while holding a sick infant, spend the least amount of time possible in close contact and try to wear a face mask or even an extra protective N95 respirator. There was also this, a step-by-step podcast of how to put on that respirator.
Place the respirator on your face with the nose piece at your fingertips, allowing the headbands to hang freely below your hand. Position
to Jen Hodson, who'd been sitting up at night holding her sick child's hand, that all sounded like mom as fumigator in chief.
I wondered that if the people who wrote it have kids or know what it's like to have kids, that would terrify them. It's like that scene in E.T. where the people come in the suits, you know, it's horrifying.
And that's a big problem, says Dr. Bernard Dreyer, a health literacy researcher and pediatrician at New York University.
People look at this website and sort of get overwhelmed. Oh, my God, am I supposed to do this? Am I supposed to do that? And then they end up not doing anything.
Dr. Dreyer has been working on a much simpler list for the American Academy of Pediatrics.
I would focus on the washing the hands and washing the child's hands. And I would mention using hand sanitizers and getting that in the house.
Teach kids to cough into their elbows or sleeves if they can.
And then I would talk about not sharing spoons and dishes and, you know, washing things down once a day. Those would be the things I would tell them to do.
But what about the mask? Portland mom Jen Hodson has asthma. It's mild, but according to the CDC website, she's one of those people who should wear a mask around anyone with swine flu. Dr. Dreyer's opinion is more nuanced.
It's hard to tell a mother to wear a mask with a kid. You know, if somebody had mild asthma, I would probably not get too excited about it. If it's somebody with real chronic lung disease, really bad asthma, chronic bronchitis, I would be more worried about them, and I would say maybe you should wear a mask.
Dr. Dreyer was so alarmed when he saw the web advice that he fired off a note to the CDC. Dr. Ann Schuchat, who directs the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, told us that the website is a work in progress, always being revised.
As we learn more and as we realize, well, that was confusing, people didn't get it, or it was so long that no one could find the really important part, we're still trying to really find the best ways to get good information out to people that's practical.
So why push that hypervigilance at all? Peter Sandman is a New Jersey risk communication consultant for companies and government agencies. He thinks the problem stems from the CDC's urge to help you take care of your child the way a hospital would.
That's not realistic. It's good-hearted. It's well-intentioned. It's just not smart.
Research shows that public health experts would have better success, he says, if instead of only putting out the very best, most stringent precautions, they gave parents choices. Best, good, and good enough.
I suspect if you sat down with the CDC experts who wrote this advice and said, all right, in a realistic situation where a parent can't do all of this, but if they really work hard, they can do some of it, which are the things they should sacrifice and which are the things they should try to hang on to, they'd have answers.
In the meantime, Bernard Dreyer and the American Academy of Pediatrics will be putting out their own how-to list online in the next few weeks. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week. We probably won't have so much on flu. You'll be sorry to hear that. But we will be hearing about trigeminal neuralgia. So you'll have to listen to find out what that is. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rebecca Davis.
I got the key to the highway, built out and bound to go. I'm gonna leave here running, because walking is most too slow. I'm going back to the border, honey, where I'm better known. Because you haven't done nothing but drove a good man away from home. Give me one more kiss, mama.